You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Such a pleasure to talk to Uni Turrentini. Uni wrote the book Betraying the Nobel, which she's been on the podcast before. We talked about some of the worst winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, but now we expand out and look for the five best and five worst Nobel Prize winners in any category. It's kind of like an interesting walk through history, both good and bad, of the past 150 years since the Nobel Prize started. So with every area of life, it's hard to compare the greatest players now with the greatest players a generation ago. If they were to both play right now at the peak of their skills, the generation ago would always lose. But you have to wonder if Arthur Ashe from the 60s had learned tennis now, would he be anywhere near as good as the best tennis players now? I don't know. But it's the same thing with Nobel Prize winners. Like the amount of physics that Albert Einstein knows is actually trivially small compared to the average graduate student at any university in the world. Yeah. So it's hard to compare them at their peak. But of course, if Albert Einstein was in graduate school now, what would he discover? It would be maybe amazing. We don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point, actually.
So I'm super excited today. We're going to talk about the five best Nobel Prize winners and the five worst. And yes. I'm curious what you come up with. We've talked about Peace Prize winners in the past, and that's certainly going to be reflected on this list. But let me ask you a question, Uni. If you think about the five worst Nobel Prize winners, the main ones that come up for worst are always going to be, or almost always going to be, Nobel Peace Prize winners.
I agree. Absolutely. Also for me, because I know more about the Peace Prize than the other prizes, but also because peace is such a potentially polarizing or political issue, right? So that's when we get the warriors and the people who have done terrible things.
And it seems like also peace, as opposed to physics, is easier to understand. So I say physics because that's almost the most extreme science, and peace is almost the most extreme on the social side. But like I understand, if you put someone in front of me, I understand if they did peaceful stuff or warlike stuff. But physics, if you put a physicist in front of me, I just have to take someone's word for it that what they're doing is groundbreaking.
Yep.
And so maybe the Nobel Peace Prize committee, and you mentioned this in your book, of course, feels like they could influence events more by picking a winner. As opposed to physics, they probably just want to pick the best person and not try to influence things.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's interesting how anyone can have an opinion about the Peace Prize winner, as you said, right? Whereas, you know, for the committee, the chemistry or in medicine, right? There you have a specialized committee with people who are actual scientists or doctors, right?
I guess the best you could do with something like physics is to say, okay, somebody's discovery or invention or whatever has affected life in the years after, or it didn't. Like I could argue that some of the Nobel Prize winners in physics or economics or chemistry their discoveries weren't as important as people thought. That's how you judge those guys. But peace, you could take a look at a woman from Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi. I guess when they gave her the prize, they didn't know she was going to be this genocidal, leader, 15 years later, 10 years later.
Absolutely. And when we have to keep in mind with her, although I think, they should definitely revoke the prize to her, right? But she was a worthy winner when she did receive it back in, I think it was in 1991. So, it's a long time ago. And she was someone who was fighting for democracy through peaceful means and had set all the right things and did all the right things. So She was a worthy winner back then.
Yeah. Was she more worthy than others back then?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah. Well, that's a great question. Of course, there have been worthy winners that never received the Peace Prize, right? So it's a good question.
Like, who do you think, like, I'll start it off with what I think is maybe not the worst winner, Nobel Prize winner, but maybe the worst decision by the Nobel Peace Prize,
yeah.
Which was, and you know, not including Gandhi in 1948. He was still alive. They could have chosen him, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe he was still alive. And he had kind of created the whole philosophy of having a revolutionary movement without any violence at all. And mm-hmm. he, you know, took over India. Like, he beat the British army and took over all of India. It's like this amazing accomplishment. Now, he's had his faults, and, you know, Pakistan and Bangladesh, sure. all everything fell apart a little bit. But
yeah,
he arguably could have been included, not just for what he did, but for the effect he had on, like, Martin Luther King and other
Absolutely.
Leaders later on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you think they didn't include him?
I think possibly there was a political element in that, because Norway has always been close with the United Kingdom and the British, and the British were important for the Norwegians before World War II, but also especially after. It was an important ally. And, you know, pretty much they were housing, they saved the Norwegian royal family during the war and let them stay in the UK, partly, you know, some of them stayed in the US as well, but it's an important ally for Norway politically and historically. So maybe they didn't want to offend the British. It's possible.
Yeah, see, when it gets political like that, and it's only with the Peace Prize it gets political, maybe literature yeah. as well. I don't know.
A little bit in literature, but less, of course, because again, with literature, a lot of people don't read, right? Or they don't really care.
Yeah.
But with the Peace Prize, you know, anyone in the world can have an opinion.
So okay, who do you think is, out of all the categories, who do you think is the Nobel Prize winner? I don't know, say is the best is almost like a childish word, but let's just say best.
You know, it was really, it was easier for me to pick the worst ones than the best ones, right? But if I were to...
That's the problem.
Exactly, yeah. But I thought about it. And my number one is Karl von Ossietzky. He won the Peace Prize in 1936.
Oh, wait, I'm going to look it up. How do you spell his last name?
So Ossietzky, that's Ossietzky.
Wow.
He was a German journalist. And he was a prisoner of the Nazis, and he was it was such a courageous man, and that's why I think he was such a worthy winner back in 36. He was the one. He was probably the only one who alerted the world to the fact that Germany was secretly rearming itself, and which was in violation of the Versailles Treaty and Germany's own laws. And because he did that, because he was a journalist and he wrote about it and he published and he told the world about this. And because of this, he was sent to prison and concentration camps. And the fact that he received the Nobel Peace Prize was actually quite risky. That was a risky move of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, because Norway hadn't been invaded yet by Germany, but there was a threat, right, that they would invade Norway. And so a lot of Norwegians didn't want Ossietzky to win the prize, because they said, we don't want to provoke Germany and Hitler. And who knows, right, if the prize actually provoked, you know, if that was part of the reason why Germany did invade Norway in 1939, but he did receive it, and that was a really courageous prize. And contrary to what the committee has done so many other times when they haven't showed courage, right? Like when they didn't want to go against the British and give the prize to Gandhi.
So it's interesting, during the year 1935, he did not win the Nobel Prize. In fact, I'm reading here that the Nobel Committee didn't give the Nobel Peace Prize to anybody in 1935. They kind of stated that nobody yep. fit the criteria. They waited until 1936 to give it to him. And I wonder if that's because he was on the eve of his death, basically, when they gave it to him. And it says here, two members of the prize committee
resigned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a really interesting, it's historically interesting this year, 35, 36 of the Nobel Peace Prize as an institution, because until that year, you could be an active politician sitting on the government and also be part of the committee, of the Nobel Peace Prize committee. So one of the people who resigned was the foreign minister. And then there was a former prime minister who also resigned. And they did it to create a distance between the committee and the Norwegian government. So in an attempt to appease the Germans, right? So after that, they decided that you cannot be on the committee if you are an active politician. But what has happened is that they elect these former politicians that, you know, so you have all these political veterans on the committee.
And so what were they thinking when they were they worried? Well, first off, how do you say his name? Osiecki,
yeah.
He was basically on the left. And as you said, they were conservative politicians, so they might have disagreed with him on that. But I guess, like you said, they were probably nervous about the effect this would have on Hitler. Like, apparently the German press wouldn't mention it at all that he won because he had already been arrested by them. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
it was very controversial. It's also interesting that even though he was on the left, he didn't support the Socialist Party in Germany, which eventually became the National Socialist Party, which was the Nazi Party. So he had a lot of foresight in, seeing what was there to come. It's almost like completely on the opposite spectrum. And by the way, this is what I'm about to say is a criticism of the Peace Prize Committee and not of the person who won. But Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize in what, 2007, before he had even done anything. And
in
even he admitted,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, even he admitted he hadn't done anything yet. But they wanted to kind of influence events rather than, compared to someone who won it for extreme courage and, he was willing to be arrested, he risked his life, it kind of went all the way, almost, 50 years, 70 years later, went completely in the other direction.
Yeah, for sure. And what's interesting about the 2009 prize to Obama is that they wanted to influence and encourage him to continue in a certain direction, right? But also, it was that prize was also a slap in the face to the Bush administration that was the previous administration from Obama. So it wasn't only a prize to award Obama. It was the last prize in a numerous prizes that were given as a slap in the face to the Bush administration in the U.S.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if Obama, if that's his proudest moment or not, but it was definitely a weird thing for the Peace Prize. And you pointed this out in your great book, Betraying the Nobel, The Secrets and Corruption Behind the Nobel Peace Prize by Uni Turrettini. I do have one worst Nobel Prize that isn't a peace prize. I have at least one. And so it's the guy who invented the frontal lobotomy won the Nobel Peace Prize in Physiology or Medicine, Antonio Egas Moniz. And we didn't really know then the effect that lobotomies would have on people. But, when someone has a lobotomy, they essentially lose, their personality. They lose they lose all their mental faculties. It's not, he thought it was a great, to his credit, he thought it was a great way to help people with severe mental illness, but it ended up being misused. People would send their, misbehaving children to get lobotomies. Notably, one of John F. Kennedy's sisters had what was believed to be a lobotomy when her family couldn't handle her anymore. And so I think it was a very, it's caused a lot of harm to society in general. I think In the U.S. alone, there's been over 20,000 lobotomies performed, and we knew from the beginning there were serious side effects, but it was definitely not necessarily worthy of the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1949.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is a horrific one. That's a really good one to bring up.
Like, obviously, there are problems it solves, but it's like saying killing someone could stop their behavioral disorder. So it's not Absolutely. Necessarily the best thing. Well, what's another good one?
Oh, so for me, actually, this year's prize, the 2021 Peace Prize to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov, this is actually one of my favorite, all-time favorite wow. Peace Prizes.
Maybe they read your book and said, we better put up some good winners.
Yeah. So the reason why I really like this year's prize, it's that, you know, they Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov are journalists. Investigative journalist Maria Ressa from the Philippines and Dmitry Murato, he's from Russia. And they both risk their lives to report the truth and to report the news, right? And, you know, we also know that Maria Ressa has been threatened on national television by the president in the Philippines. He's said that he's going to kill her. So on television, on national television. So it's really,
wow, so
you know,
she was a citizen of the Philippines. Was she living in the Philippines at the time?
She's still living there. Yeah.
And he said he was going to kill her. She wasn't in jail or anything at that time.
No, absolutely. Now they're threatening of putting her in jail for other reasons, you know, for, you know, conspiracy, all sorts of things. So that, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But hopefully the Peace Prize will save her in the sense that they won't try to kill her or put her in prison. But we'll see.
So let me ask you a question. If you had the opportunity to be like Maria Ressa and state something that you felt was really important against society, knowing that you could be put in jail, and let's say, I don't know if she has a family or whatever, but would you do it? I don't know if I would do it. I don't know if I'd want my freedom taken away for writing something that probably won't have any effect.
I know. And that's why I think it's so extremely courageous, because I don't know if I would have the courage to do that. So I think it's you know, even more important that they do reward people who are that courageous, that shows that they are willing to actually sacrifice their own lives to protect our freedom of expression and also our right, our general, you know, everybody's right to information. And I think it's important, and especially, you know, even just think about this whole polarizing vaccination policy, the conversation, right? And how, and like, I don't know about you, but I'm not against, let's say, the vaccination, you know, of during this pandemic. I'm not at all against it. But what I am, you know, what I'm reacting to is the lack of tolerance for the opposition. Is that, you know, why are we not inviting people who are skeptical and people who have questions to the table for a conversation, because there are different sides to it, right? So that's what I'm reacting to. And I think that's what this, the Peace Prize to Ressa and Murato is in a way that it's a shout out to our right to information and our freedom of expression. So I think today it's even more relevant. I don't think that the committee, though, had this in mind. This is just my interpretation, but I take it as a really positive sign. And you know, because our democracy, the way I see it, is under attack, and not just by, you know, dictators, but by governments and media everywhere.
Right. And you make a great point that, by the way, you should write an article on this. You should write an article on what we could learn from this year's Nobel Peace Prize winners, because for two reasons. One is, I didn't even know who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021. Like, I feel like it's just not, it just doesn't get out there anymore. And the other thing is that you're right. I feel like in the past 3 or 4 years, maybe less, maybe more, you really, there's always been people who disagree and who hate each other for disagreeing. But now, in particular, like take the vaccine thing you mentioned. So I legitimately am curious whether if you had COVID, what kind of immunity you get versus the vaccine.
Right.
And also, and this is not an anti-vax stance, I just want to know the numbers, because I've had COVID less than 6 months ago, and I legitimately want to know if I should get vaccinated now. And on the podcast a few weeks ago, we had a woman who was vaccinated, who is a doctor and a Harvard researcher and wrote a book about COVID. And she told me it would be useless for me right now. I should wait a few more months. And yet, but that means I can't go, like in cities like New York City, I can't go into a restaurant because you need a vaccine card. And so I'm just curious when, and then the other thing I'm curious about is, what are the statistics on transmitting the disease once you've been vaccinated? Because apparently it doesn't stop the disease, so you could still transmit it. So then I wonder what the, is that normal for vaccines? Or I just want to know answers to a bunch of questions. And you really can't, like if I were to ask them on Twitter, I am in danger of having my account banned on, let's say, any social media, not just Twitter, Facebook, Twitter. And meanwhile, I've gotten death threats on Twitter and I've reported them. And I get back a message saying, oh no, this person did not violate our policies. So I get disturbed about, it seems like there's a hypocrisy when I have legit questions, like I'm going to get vaccinated, but I have legit questions about health related to it, particularly since I've had it already. So
And these are great questions. And I'm actually in the same situation as you, because I had COVID before I got vaccinated too. And I'm also, you know, asking myself those very same questions. And I'm not like, I don't consider myself an anti-vaxxer or whatever they call it, right? And I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist either, or an extremist. But I do have questions, and I think it would be interesting to invite the other side to the table, to the conversation. And I don't understand why it's dangerous, why it's a threat to allow different viewpoints to come to light. The only places in the world up until now where we were not allowed to have an opposition are in dictatorships, right? In totalitarian states like Russia and other places. Well, now it seems like we are really getting close to becoming totalitarian when it comes to this conversation in our parts of the world too. And that really frightens me. So this is why also I think that this year's prize is even more important. And you're right, I'm going to write an article about that. That's really a good point.
Yeah, because it sort of shows that alongside the arguments you made in your book, there's an argument to be made that, look, we need to still pay attention to what's happening here. And this is a very prestigious prize still. And it is clear, for better or for worse, that they send messages by who they pick. And in this case, it happens to be a message we should listen to.
Exactly. Because what happens also when you cut people out and you exclude them and you shame them for their opinions, what happens is that you drive them toward conspiracy theorists. You drive them toward more extreme ideas and polarization. And that creates conflict. That creates, you know, riots, demonstrations, protests, and potential violence, right? So the opposite of peace.
Yeah. So, okay, I agree with you on that, that this is a good one, the 2021 prize.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go outside of the peace prize for a good one. I do think my number one for a good pick is Watson and Crick for the discovery of the shape of DNA, of the DNA
module.
So Francis Crick and James Watson.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm.
The idea being that over the next, because of what they started and because of now the innovations in sequencing the human genome is so cheap now, that the amount of diseases that are going to be cured, we can't even imagine. Like right now we cured diseases by whether it's chemotherapy or complicated, cocktails of medicine. We're eventually going to be able to use gene editing, similar to the Nobel Prize in medicine last year. I guess it was the woman who invented CRISPR, so which is sort of the tail end of what Watson and Crick started. But this is going to change all of medicine. Like we're going to basically be able to cure almost all diseases eventually because of our understanding of DNA, which they kicked off.
Yeah, Wow. Yeah, that's a good one.
So
that's
like really basically one. Curing all of disease has to be up there.
For sure, especially now, right?
I didn't know why. So they specifically wanted for, because they discovered what the shape of the DNA was. It was a double helix.
Yep.
And I didn't know why it's important, the shape, but I guess it could lead, it's helpful to know what the shape is because that's how it attaches to proteins in and cells in the body and how it does its magic, how it changes your body by because of the shape. And also, I guess it helps with sequencing the genome. So,
yeah.
And then for a good one, I kept debating whether Marie Curie was a good one or not because, okay, she discovered radioactivity, which she and her husband, Pierre, discovered radioactivity, which you can argue was going to be discovered anyway, sooner or later. And there was some risk to it. You know, she ended up dying from the radioactive exposure because she got exposed to radioactivity so much, but she never admitted that she died from it. She also won 2 Nobel Prizes, one in physics and one in chemistry. And I think her daughter won the prize. Her husband won the prize. Like, this is like the biggest family in the Nobel Prize history. So arguably she's very, very important. But again, I always wonder about prizes where it probably would have been discovered anyway. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. But clearly she did it at great personal risk and it did change the entire field of physics.
Yes. And I think for me anyway with her is that the fact that she, you know, she was a woman and she probably should have won the prize before, right? And they waited to give it. And the first one they gave it, she had to share it with another man. And so they have been, you know, because of the fact that she was a woman, they hesitated to give her the prize. And I think that's makes her, I think for sure, worthy of the prize, probably more than a lot of other people.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. That I don't know how many women were chosen before her, but she definitely like changed the scope of science and, you know, as a woman showed that, hey, I mean, she's still quoted as like a woman who was successful in the sciences and is an inspiration to young girls who want to go into science and so on. And, you know, I do wonder what benefits they immediately thought were going to happen from radiation, but clearly just the fact that it emits light, emits particles, you know, there was a sense that this would be a way to create energy even right from the very beginning. And of course, then that leads to another, what I think is a controversial pick, but maybe many people would argue it's not so controversial. I always wonder, why did Einstein win the Nobel Prize? Like, who actually understood what he was doing? And I never quite figured out why he won it.
And also, didn't he win? I believe he won for, you know, the reasoning for picking Einstein also. He won it the prize in physics in 1921, but the citation, they didn't mention anything about the theory of relativity, and they just spoke very vaguely about some unspecified services to theoretical physics. So it was really a strange prize.
Yeah, I think he didn't win for that. Again, I don't think you win for something, right? You win for a lifetime of work. But I think they stated for his services to theoretical physics and especially for his discovery of the law of the photoelectric effect. So the idea that atoms, when they're bombarded with light, can also emit light back. So, you know, which kind of led to, you know, also nuclear power and all that. It's related to Marie Curie's prize. But I think that with the theory of relativity, I don't really know what you use with that. Particularly like he was awarded in 1921. Yeah. There wasn't a sense of like nuclear weapons, which was kind of the first mega use of the theory of relativity, the fact that so much energy could be created with so little matter. I think... He had his look and his appearance, which makes him look like the smartest person ever. But I never really that clear like why he won, although he was considered kind of the smartest person around then. So I think it was just like they figured, well, why not give it to him? He's clearly a smart guy and he did something. So, but you know, again, though, let's take another good one from medicine where I think the effects were immediate, that the benefits of what this person invented were immediate, which is Alexander Fleming, who discovered that this fungus that grew in his lab was an antibiotic, a very powerful antibiotic, which he named penicillin. And of course, penicillin cures almost every type of infection you could have.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good one.
Yeah.
That's a really good one. Yeah.
And that's one of those, it's a great one to study because it's one of those ones where he was researching antibiotics and he was researching bacteria and how to kill it. And then he went on vacation. And when he got back, he realized he had left some of these Petri dishes exposed and fungus grew on them. Like, and that in fact, you know, it was that accidental discovery that created penicillin ultimately, which, you know, to some extent we still use descendants of penicillin. Like it's his cure is still around.
Still around and still, yeah, absolutely. That's a really good one. And imagine how many lives that has saved, right? Like how that's really changed humanity.
Yeah. So whereas Einstein, eventually it changed humanity, but I'm just always unclear what, you know, how, you know, did he realize back then it would change humanity? I mean, it was theoretical physics. That's why, like, you know, Werner Heisenberg also, who received the Nobel Prize in physics for essentially discovering quantum mechanics. I always wonder, like, what use is quantum mechanics? I mean, I'm sure physicists would be horrified at me saying this, but at the time it was just really theoretical. So I'm not sure you can just give it to somebody who just seems really smart. I'd rather it be given to somebody who it has an effect on society almost immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, this reminds me though, that the in medicine, I don't know much about it, but I read that in 1923, they gave the prize to Sir Frederick Banting for the discovery of insulin, right? Which is super important and still, you know, in use today and very much saving lives. But that year, Banting had to share the prize with this other guy called MacLeod. And nobody knows what MacLeod really did because he didn't participate in the discovery of insulin. So what I read anyway was that MacLeod's only contribution was that he provided a laboratory space and he gave some general business advice to Sir Frederick Banting. So that's also like kind of a curious that they would, you know, he would receive the Nobel Prize in medicine.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point too, that how much is the people who, let's say, maybe they're not scientists or inventors, but they fund and enable the guys who, like for instance, Pierre Amadiar, who started, you know, he started eBay and now he gives like billions of dollars to charity. He funds a lot of science that has resulted in the Nobel Prize. Do we ever give it to someone like that who's an enabler?
That's a good point, actually. Maybe he did deserve it, right? So that's a good point. I haven't thought about that.
No, actually, Maria Ressa, Amadiar helped fund her,
oh,
yes.
Oh, really? So he's definitely a good guy then.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb, while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. It's interesting because it's very hard to be, like you were just pointing out, it's very hard to be an activist because of the the personal risk. So I was just at this conference. Yeah. It was a human rights conference. The, I forget the name of the conference now. The Oslo Freedom Forum started in Oslo right near you. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's interesting. There were a lot of activists speaking and I had a chance a little bit to speak with the head of the Freedom Foundation. And they have to be very careful when an activist approaches them because they want to make sure, A, he or she is a real activist and not somebody put up there by the government. And they also want to make sure that psychologically the activist could handle what's going to happen because, you know, their family could be harassed, they could be harassed, they could be put in jail, they could be killed, people they know they could be killed. So psychologically, you have to really be, you know, a strong character. And again, I don't know if I would be that strong. And then also there's a skill to activism, particularly in a country that locks down all human rights. Like you have to know how to essentially activism is a form of performance art. Like you have to know how to, you know, create attention when no attention is allowed.
Yes.
So this conference was a lot of it was about how they teach activists how to, they basically train activists to do what they do. Like what does it mean to be an activist? What is activism in a country that, you know, suppresses all human rights? So it's interesting, but these enablers, you know, like Omidyar or this Oslo Freedom Organization, they're very crucial to the process. Or like this guy Banting, who helped fund a scientific process.
Absolutely.
What's another good one?
So let's look at I think my number three, and this goes back to the Peace Prize of 1905 that went to Bertha von Suttner. And the reason why I like her so much, first of all, she was the first woman to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize. And she is the inspiration for Alfred Nobel to create these prizes and to give away most of his money to all the different Nobel Prizes in the first place. So that's why I think she has a crucial role and is a worthy winner. Now, she was one of the first really leaders in the peace movement back in her time. And you can say that, you know, you can argue that she wasn't successful because, you know, afterwards we had World War I and World War II and all of that. But I do think that her work and all the peace activists, their work is still important, even if they weren't per se successful, right? That they managed to create peace. And I don't think we're going to see anyone in the next, I don't know, foreseeable future that will actually manage to create world peace, right? But I think still think we have to reward the people who are activists and are trying. And she definitely did a lot for the peace movement. So, and she had a lot of courage too. I like people who have courage.
Well, it's a good question actually. Like who, you know, what is world peace? Does that mean there's no suppression of human rights anywhere? Or does that mean there's no, like if no leader was corrupt and no leader suppressed human rights, I guess you could argue we would have no war because, you know, for instance, like I'm just trying to think of a common example, like, you know, Iraq invaded Kuwait in the early 90s because he already was used to suppressing human rights. So why not invade another country? Yep. I'm not saying that was his argument, but, you know, I guess with world peace, you could say, and again, there's always that expression, countries should either trade bullets or money. So, you know, bullets are goods. And so I guess as countries get more and more economically developed, that might be the fastest way to have world peace.
Absolutely. I think you know, the foundations for conflict are, you know, suppression, violence, you know, violating human rights and poverty, right? If people are poor, they will riot eventually. They will stand up.
That's true. So, although in general, the world has become less poor. Like as technology creates, you know, and I know some people are against like, you know, genetically modified foods, like GMO foods, but, you know, ultimately they feed an extra billion or two people. And there's various technologies like that, that have fed more and more people. So, I wonder if there's any peace activists that actually really move the needle more than simply economic development.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And someone that they did give the Peace Prize to was Muhammad Yunus, who sort of, I don't know if he invented micro loans, but, you know, that was his, you know, he's that's what he's known for, giving these small, you know, micro loans to poor people in Bangladesh. And he won the Peace Prize in 2006. Now, you know, back then, a lot of people and celebrities were rooting for Muhammad Yunus, that, you know, he did so much for poor people. Now, he's not on my list of worthy winners. He is on my list of the worst winners, actually.
Yeah, because isn't there a lot of evidence? I think we talked about this even before
on
the last one.
Yeah, we did.
There was a lot of evidence that this microlending has caused problems. Yeah. Maybe what were those problems?
So what has happened is that poor people take up these microloans from his bank and other similar banks, right? But because the interest rates are so high, they can't repay the loans. So they're forced to turn to loan sharks and other, you know, terrible people. And that that has resulted in suicide epidemics in certain regions. So it's actually more evidence to that shows that he's increased poverty and made, you know, the situation worse than it was before. And that they also, with these microloans, a lot of the times they also, in order to get the loan, they have to sign up to get a mobile phone, and so they have a subscription, you know, all that stuff that they don't necessarily need.
Why did they had to get a phone because it was transferred to them? They used the technology of the phone to transfer money to them, or
not necessarily. No, actually not, because these people, you know, they were just given the money. They went to the bank and they got the cash, right? So that's what happened. Mm-hmm. But because, you know, they're trying to force these poor people, already poor people, to become consumers.
Yeah.
You know, to buy all these different products like phones and other products and insurances and all sorts of things that they can't really pay for. So they have to loan more money, to borrow more money in order to pay for all these consumer goods that they, you know, are forced to take.
So let's say you were Muhammad Yunus back then when he started microlending. Yeah. The way to do it is oddly how Michael Milken discovered that junk bonds were interesting investments. He basically looked statistically at really low-rated loans made to mostly shitty corporations, and mm-hmm. he determined that more often than expected, they paid back the loan. And so these, you know, C or D-rated loans were called junk bonds because they were considered so junky that you make a high return, but there's a risk of going bankrupt. But his model of bankruptcy, he showed that they didn't go bankrupt as much as people thought. So it became an important asset category, junk bonds. And so I wonder if Muhammad Yunus did a similar kind of statistical study where he showed that if you lend these people in these struggling countries these microloans to build businesses and so on, if they would pay them back more likely than not. Like, I wonder if he did a statistical study or if it was, it's one thing if it's just good intentions. It's another thing if it's good intentions combined with, hey, it turns out this is a valuable investment category. And while that sounds almost too materialistic to look at it that way, that really is how it becomes the most effective. If people
absolutely.
Have economic incentive to do microloans, then he's done. He did his job. He doesn't have to encourage something that, when you encourage something that doesn't have economic incentive, eventually it comes back to bite you, as it happened here.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I wonder if he did research.
He probably did the research, and also the way that these microloans were constructed, because they didn't have any material collateral for the banks to have a guarantee. So what they did was that they grouped, you know, these neighbors and people together. So a group of women, for example, which you know, he's famous for trying to help poor women to rise up and create businesses with these microloans. But what happened was these groups of women, so they were put together in a group. And then what happens is that if one of the women defaults, so she can't pay the interest that week, the other women have to pay for her. And that, of course, they're all struggling and none of them can, you know, they're all struggling to just make it their own little part, right? So if they have to take on another person's part, so that created a lot of, they beat each other up. There were exclusions, you know, it was such a shameful to not be able to pay your part because you were then shamed and excluded from your community, right? Because of, you know, the other people were then hurting in the group. So you have the group as collateral. And I think that just creates a really unhealthy environment for everyone, apart from the bank, because they were the ones always getting their money or almost always getting their money.
Often good intentions have horrible consequences.
Yeah.
And one example in the United States is during the 90s, the Clinton administration created, I'm going to simplify it, but created kind of a quota for banks to make subprime loans so more people could borrow money to own houses. Forgetting the fact that until now, we've had pretty low inflation since the 90s, and it was unclear you really needed to own a home to be happy, for instance. But the creation of subprime loans created this whole asset class that wasn't really statistically valid, as it turns out, in the 2008 financial crisis. Like, people defaulted more than was thought, and, you know, entire banks went out of business trying to collect these loans. So again, it was great intentions, but had horrible consequences. And you have to wonder this with every major decision. Like, we still don't know the effects of the economic lockdowns, for instance, in this last year. Like, how many people had medical problems because they were, and how many people committed suicide? How many people, you know, lost their livelihoods and their families' livelihoods, and that creates medical issues. So we'll never know the full effects of that. But it was a good intention, which is less people get COVID. So we just don't know the answer.
Exactly. Yep.
Here's another one of omission. This is related to one of our worst ones. So how do you say the name of the Myanmar woman again?
Aung San Suu Kyi.
Yeah, so she won in 1991. Obviously, she had spent decades in prison. There was another person who was actually offered the prize in 1991 before her, which was Vaclav Havel, former Czech president.
Yeah.
And he never admitted that, actually, but she said it, that she was called and told that he had been offered it and that he refused it. I don't know why he refused it. And she was offered it instead. And she said that he was such a source of inspiration for her when she was in prison. And obviously, this is a Peace Prize winner who did have an effect on the world. Like, he you know, wrote for years, you know, he was in the Czechoslovakia, which was communist. He wrote for years against communism and kind of the fascist tendencies of communism. He went to prison for it. And then he negotiated the change of power in I guess it was like 1989 or 1990. And he became president of the Czech Republic. This playwright became the president of the Czech Republic and seems to have been a good leader. I don't know of anybody who says anything really bad about him, but he was apparently offered the prize. I don't know why he refused it, though.
That's something that I haven't heard of. And I only know of one person who actually refused the prize. Well, you know, we don't know this because of course, you know, the records of anything is held secret, right? So maybe they did offer it to him and it's just not public information, but this was a leak maybe. But what the only person that I know of that refused the prize was the leader of North Vietnam, who won the prize together with Henry Kissinger.
Oh, yeah, for the Paris Peace Accords.
Exactly. That ended the Vietnam War. And of course, that one was a horrible prize because there was no peace in Vietnam. And the United States, you know, was carpet bombing Vietnam and Cambodia and that region while they were handed the medal.
And I forget, didn't he say something like, I'm not going to accept it because there is no peace yet? Like, I'm not going to accept it until there's actual peace.
Yeah. And then the committee responded with, well, we're not going to accept that you reject the prize. So we're still going to give it to you. You're still on the record officially as a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, he just chose not to pick up his medal or the money, right? But he's still on the record as an official Peace Prize winner.
That's so interesting. And meanwhile, like, I guess plenty of people who were kind of ambivalent about the prize, the Nobel Prize, could have rejected it. So Obama was ambivalent about it. Bob Dylan, I don't think Bob Dylan even showed up for, you know, he won the Nobel Prize in Literature. I don't think he even showed up in Sweden to collect it. And so plenty of people haven't cared, but they still, I guess, took the check and, or at least, acknowledged taking the prize. I think even Bob Dylan eventually said, he won it.
You know, in the end, he did accept it. Like 3 months later or something. First of all, they couldn't get a hold of him, you know, to tell him that he won. And then he responded 3 months later that he accepted it. And then he had to, in order to receive the money and the medal, he had to give a Nobel lecture. And he had to do it within 6 months of the prize. And I think the cutoff date was on June 10th that year. And then he gave his Nobel lecture on June 4th. So just before, you know, the cutoff date. So that was kind of funny.
Did he have a good lecture? Do you know?
I read it. It was actually, he did it at a concert, as part of a concert. And it was kind of just, it sounded like he wasn't really interested in the prize or interested in receiving it. And he didn't really understand why he got it. That's the way it sounded to me, you know, his Nobel lecture, because it wasn't really of any interest to the prize.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, yeah. But speaking of the Nobel Prize in literature, it's hard to say who's good and who's bad because it's so subjective. Mm-hmm. And first off, there's a lot of omissions, like James Joyce, who's considered one of the best writers ever, never won it. But I would say the best awarded prize was Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He's almost the equivalent of a Peace Prize winner. Like, basically, he wrote against Russian authoritarianism. Yeah. He spent years in Siberia. He wrote the book, The Gulag Archipelago, which is like an unbelievably well-written book about his experience in Siberia. And, you know, and his book was kind of passed around underground and in the Soviet Union just to kind of show that there were people fighting communism. You know, that was probably a good use of the Nobel Prize in literature.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree with you also that it's really kind of difficult to know. But there's been a lot of criticism of the literature prize that, you know, like you said, a lot of people who deserved it didn't get it, you know, and they didn't give it to Proust or to Joyce, or, you know, there's so many people who were worthy winners. And then it seems also that sometimes there's, you know, there's politics in the literature prize as well, you know, and who they give it to. There's like a lot of Scandinavian authors that received it that nobody's heard of and that weren't really great writers, but then they didn't give it to like probably the two Scandinavian writers that have had the most impact. You know, Henrik Ibsen is a Norwegian one who's done a lot, right? And who's world famous today, or Strindberg, you know? So there's something strange.
Yeah, the literature one's weird. I think it's just a matter of like who's both literary and popular. And there's no controversy. Exactly. So like James Joyce, I think they didn't give it to him because he had too much blasphemy. I don't know why with Ibsen. You know, and then Ernest Hemingway got the prize. You know, regardless of what you think of his books, maybe he deserved it, but it was definitely, he was a larger than life character. And I think that helped him as well. Like, I think personality helps you get noticed and win these sorts of prizes. Like if Malala, who I do think was very brave and deserved the Nobel Peace Prize, but she was put in the media all over the place and was very brave to do so. I mean, she got shot in the face for it, but there might've been other kids that we don't know about who have been treated far worse, who, and I'm not criticizing Malala here. Yeah. Like, I think she's great. But by the way, she just got married too, which shows us how old we were. Like she was—
I saw that. Yeah. And she just graduated from college too.
All our Nobel Prize winners are growing up. So all the child ones.
Exactly.
But yeah, the literature one's a weird one. Like, I don't know. That's why Solzhenitsyn stands out. And someone like Hemingway, I thought about, but doesn't quite, and I love Hemingway's writing. I probably read Old Man and the Sea once a year, but because it's a great written book.
It's such a great book.
I don't know what it means to get the prize. There's also a lot of literature winners who nobody's ever heard of and nobody will ever read again.
Absolutely.
I'll throw in one more science one, Hermann Muller. So in the 20s, he discovered that, and this is what Marie Curie did not discover, he discovered that there is a link between exposure to radiation and dying from mutations in your cells. So not only did he make this scientific discovery, but because of this scientific discovery, he's been a strong advocate for not using nuclear weapons because you're going to end up killing people, many civilians.
Although I have to say, though, right now, what we're seeing, I don't know if the United States, but over here in Europe, anyway, there's a lot of talk about nuclear energy.
Yeah.
And for so many years, I mean, I remember, you know, growing up where, you know, with demonstrations and protests in the streets that we did not want nuclear energy, right? And in Norway, that's fine because we have hydroelectricity and we have so many other, you know, options, right? But, you know, in Switzerland, for instance, they're preparing the populations for blackouts in the next 5 years. They're saying, you know, we're going to have blackouts of electricity. So a nuclear energy is the cleanest energy. And I think, I can't think why we can't have safe installations with nuclear energy?
Well, we totally right? can. And the thing is, you look at, there's been three major reactor accidents in history. I'm sure yeah. there's been more, but these are the major ones in the public's eye and probably in terms of like illness and death. So there's Three Mile Island in the US, which I think was in 1979. There was Chernobyl and yeah. there's Fukushima in
yeah.
2011. But all of these reactors used very kind of 1940s or 1950s technology in building their yeah. reactors. And now mm-hmm. the technology has advanced so much, but I mean, the US doesn't build any nuclear reactors at all. There's no way to, you know, I think France powers itself completely with nuclear energy, but I don't know of too many other countries that do. Without going into all the technology, there's other elements yeah. we can use other than plutonium to create, yeah. you know, nuclear reactors. There's, right. there's thorium, which is easier to contain. There's they use mm-hmm. liquid salts instead of these very hot radioactive rods. So it's not as dangerous right now to build
yeah.
a nuclear reactor. So you're right. Like, everybody talks about green energy. This is the greenest energy of all. It will completely exactly. eliminate the need for fossil yeah. fuels to generate electricity. Yeah. And
yeah.
you would only need a small amount to generate all the mm-hmm. electricity for a country for thousands yeah. of years. And even
and
nuclear waste you can reuse.
And you
don't
depend on the weather or, you know, sunlight or anything, right? So you can, this is like, it goes on its own. It, you don't need to depend on solar or wind or anything.
Right now, and it won't always be this way, but right now, solar power and wind are too expensive. Like, to generate, let's say, a mm-hmm. dollar's worth of electricity might cost,
yeah.
you know, $1.50. I'm making these numbers up, but it's you have to, the government has to subsidize solar power and yeah. energy. Now, yeah. that won't be the case forever, but like you said, nuclear reactors, there's no issue. Like, it's clearly the best energy source.
Yeah.
Nuclear fusion is on the horizon as well, but it's the law in the U.S. that no one's just building nuclear reactors, and you're not allowed to reuse nuclear waste in most cases. So, mm-hmm. which is also a viable source of nuclear energy. It's kind of a shame that, you know, such important technology as this, and considering the problems that people see in climate change and man-made climate change and fossil fuels and all that, here's a solution. Nobody, yeah. they'd rather I like recycle a can of Coke, which does nothing, instead of advocating for nuclear reactors. And everybody yeah. everybody who yeah. says is against climate change will also protest not in my backyard and for
exactly.
nuclear reactors.
Exactly. I just don't get it. Like, I got it in the 80s, but not today, right? So, yeah.
I can understand why people are scared about it because, you know, things like Chernobyl was horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if
yep.
anybody could live there even now. But
I don't think so. No. Mm-hmm.
But technology has improved so much and nobody really does the research on this. Like, you can build a nuclear reactor so much safer. And even with 70-year-old technology, there's only been really three, you know, massive events that I could think of. I mean, there's been other events, but those were massive
yeah,
absolutely.
Ones. Absolutely.
I mean, obviously there's tons of good prizes that have been offered for medicine, for physics, for chemistry. Mm-hmm. I think we were trying to pick the best ones and we've talked about the worst ones. I don't know if anything else stands out.
For my favorite, like, top five, I have two more, and those are both in peace. And so one is to Martin Luther King Jr., which I think is an obvious one, right? And he won in 1964. And he's just, and I think also because he was really inspired by Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi didn't get it, but Dr. King got the prize. And I think that's sort of and he was such a worthy winner, first of all, and in the same, you know, the same type of person as Gandhi, right? The same, you know, courage and, you know, seeking peace through non-violence and just peaceful means. And I think it's just everything that Alfred Nobel wanted with his Peace Prize winners. So definitely Martin Luther King, and then Desmond Tutu.
Oh yeah,
you know, for his role in such a unifying leader figure in South Africa, and for, you know, tearing down the apartheid going on. So and also, I think Desmond Tutu has the years following, he continues to be an inspiration and a leader for peace. And he talks about you know, forgiveness, and it talks about reconciliation. And it's something that I think is, can I, would you mind if I read a quote by him?
Because
he said something which I think is so valid, especially right now with everything going on, you know, with this pandemic. So he said this. He said, "Forgiving and being reconciled to our enemies or our loved ones are not about pretending that things are other than that they are. It's not about patting one another on the back and turning a blind eye to the wrong. True reconciliation exposes the awfulness, the abuse, the hurt, the truth," he said. And I think it's valid today with, and he talks about this in the sense that we have to accept and we have to forgive, and then we have to try to love anyway, right? And I think, you know, with this polarization going on, if we can just try to meet each other and have a conversation and build relationships, right? Despite of our differences and despite of the fact that we totally disagree, right? And also the fact that, like, so many people don't know. Like, we don't know. We just want information. We just want to have leaders that we can look up to and that can inspire us.
It's interesting you bring up Martin Luther King, because during these Black Lives Matter protests, a lot of people were bringing up and misquoting a very crucial quote he said, including, you know, one of my own kids. And you know, basically he'd written once, I think it was in 1957 or 58, "Writing is the voice of the unheard." And people were using that quote to justify that the rioting during the Black Lives Matter movements was correct. And I'm not saying BLM activists were using it, but just like other people were using this quote, that this was justifying it. And you know, police should stand down when the rioting is happening. But the reality is they're kind of taking his quote out of context. He does say rioting is the language of the unheard, because he's trying to explain what America was not hearing from, you know, his people, and how, you know, the plight of the poor has gotten worse and so on over the years. And so he's basically saying America has failed to listen and that rioting has been the result, but he is not justifying rioting. He's still saying that a better approach to deal with these problems is kind of this Gandhi-like approach. So I think that's an important misconception recently of Martin Luther King. He was never for violence in any sense.
Never.
And I that was a big difference between him and Malcolm X. And even though Malcolm X changed to be more like Martin Luther King, he still would advocate violence in self-defense. But not, he wouldn't, he no longer advocated like violence as a way of getting something done, other than in self-defense. But MLK, not even in self-defense, just like Gandhi.
Exactly. It was all about the nonviolent resistance. That's what they talked about, both of them. So,
So it's interesting. So between physicists and doctors and chemists who have changed their lives, and people advocating for peace who have changed our lives, I think we have got a good sense of, I think this is the good side of the Nobel Prize, is that it can reward and incentivize people to do well and improve life. And it's created these people that we look up to for inspiration that maybe we would not have noticed before, because we didn't do the work, they did the work. But of course, as you point out in Betraying the Nobel, there's a lot of bad guys and bad actors who have come out of this as well. And I wish they would kind of acknowledge that, but maybe they can't.
Maybe they can't, and probably they can't, right? But what I do think with this year's prize to these journalists and extreme, you know, like the courage that they show, and like we talked about, like I don't know if I have the courage to go out there and do the same thing, right, and risk my life and risk the safety of my kids and my family, right? So I think to acknowledge their courage and to continue and to, for all of us, it's an encouragement, right? For all of us to be a little more courageous and perhaps speak a little more up, you know, speak up when we feel that there's something, some injustice, something going on that we don't agree with, or just, you know, I think it's today, disagreeing or raising questions in our society is a courageous act.
Even in the US, Which is striking.
Even in the US, even in Norway. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Which is striking, yeah.
And again, on the science side, there's probably a lot of Nobel Prizes that were awarded for useless things or even worse, things like lobotomies. Or there was another guy, Fritz Haber, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for chlorine gas and encouraged its use in gas warfare. So some of these guys are not, maybe they were smart, but maybe didn't necessarily improve the world at first glance. But I do think there's benefits and there's things we can learn from these, you know, incredible stories of people who risked everything achieved a way of thinking that they could discover completely new things when everyone said it wasn't possible. So, I mean, I'm sure every scientist had to deal with the fact that it's not possible because no one's discovered it before. Or why didn't they discover it before? Or why would you discover it? So I'm sure they had to deal with their own personal issues. But certainly on the peace side, there was a lot of great sacrificial risk involved for many of those winners. So Uni Turrettini, author of Betraying the Nobel, a great book that someone should read to see the history of the Peace Prize and the good, the bad, and very much the ugly in it. Thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about who your favorites were in the Nobel Prize, because it's not all bad.
It's not all bad. And thank you so much for having me. This has been a really fun conversation.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you.